Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Dennis Prager Show. I'm going to immediately go to my guest, Bill O'Reilly. And if he's in that enviable position of one being able to say he needs no introduction. But in case you don't know, no, it's not possible. Just to be formal, he is the man on Fox News who has the most popular news show on cable television. Bill, welcome back to the Dennis Prager Show.
Thanks for having me in, Dennis.
Sir, you are in an enviable position. I say this with absolute, in the healthiest sense. You could write a book, I do believe, if you wrote on laundry in early Massachusetts, I think it would be a bestseller.
Well, I appreciate that, but we'd like to bring a little bit more to the table. So, Killing Lincoln, this book, out of the gate real strong, 125,000 copies.
Well, you're number two on Amazon. I checked because I like to check before the guest comes on because I want them to see how
it
goes.
Number two? We were number one for 4 days. So I'm real pleased that it's holding like that.
We'll try to do something about that. I know you feel disappointed.
Well, all right, after your show, Dennis, it'll rock it right back.
That's right. It's exactly what I was saying. All right, listen. Why did you write? I know you get this question all the time. Then I have some other questions you may not get all the time. Why would you write a book on the killing of Lincoln?
Well, because we're a divided nation now, just as we were in the Civil War. And we need leadership like Abraham Lincoln provided. I believe that Abraham Lincoln is the best American president and provides the gold standard for leadership, not only in this country, but around the world. I wanted Americans to know about him, know how he suffered in the last 2 weeks of his life, what he sacrificed for his country, because that's the kind of politician we need now. We're in bad trouble, and we have to have leaders who are going to put their country ahead of themselves, which is exactly what Lincoln did. So I wrote the book in a novel form. It's true. Everything in there is true, but I wrote it like a John Grisham thriller because I wanted people who don't necessarily read history or nonfiction books to read it, and I wanted kids to read it because we need to bring the spirit of Abraham Lincoln back to this country right now.
Well, you do succeed. I'll tell you, if you pick up the book at any chapter, you just keep reading. I fully acknowledge that to be true. It happened to me.
Thank you.
All right, a number of questions here about the specific assassination. Why did we know why John Wilkes Booth did it. He hated Lincoln. Did he hate it? Did he, though, think that it would, if you would say to him, sit down with me, John Wilkes, why are you going to kill the President of the United States? What would he answer?
Well, he would answer that Lincoln was a traitor to the United States because Booth believed that the South had a perfect constitutional right to secede from the Union and run its own show. But the underlying thing was that Booth was a terrorist. He was a terrorist, just like bin Laden. And he put together a conspiracy. He didn't want to just kill Lincoln. He wanted to kill three other guys and decapitate the Union so the South would rise again because Lee's army had just been defeated. That's what Wilkes Booth's plan was. But there was a personal element. I don't know whether you got to the part where we found out, and this is just fascinating, that John Wilkes Booth's fiancée, a woman named Lucy Hale, was running around on Booth with Robert Todd Lincoln,
President Lincoln's son,
mm-hmm. who was a Union officer. We believe Booth found that out, and that drove his hatred even further.
So it was done in order to have the South rise and for personal animosity.
Correct. So Booth was a racist. He believed in slavery. He didn't want black people.
Right. Feared that there would ever be a black president, even, as you write.
Right. Right. Yeah. So Booth, he was crazy.
Okay.
In the sense that his value system was so opposite Lincoln's.
Right.
That it drove him to do this. And Booth thought he was going to be a hero. And remember, Booth almost got away with it.
Well, that's my next question. How would a guy yell, such is the fate of emperors, everybody knows who he is, and think he'll get away with it?
Well, Booth had an elaborate plan, a lot of people helping him, and some of those people got hung. And he thought he was going to be able to get to Mexico, where he wouldn't be extradited back, and he would live in splendor because all the people in the South would think he was the greatest guy and send him money and all of that. So that's what was in Booth's mind.
How did the South react to him? What did Southern newspapers say about the assassination?
Well, that's an interesting question. The unrepentant South celebrated the assassination. But at that point, Lincoln was a lot better for the intelligent South than the alternative, which was Johnson, the vice president, because Johnson wanted to kick everybody's butt, whereas Lincoln wanted reconciliation. He didn't want to punish the South, and Johnson did. So the intelligentsia in the South didn't want Lincoln dead, but the racists and people like that, they were happy he was killed.
Mary Lincoln was a depressed person, probably biochemically, and tell me if you don't agree, and certainly because of the death of Willie, their beloved son.
Right.
What did the assassination of her husband, did it send her over the edge?
Yeah, she had to be committed a few years later by Robert Todd Lincoln, her son. She was actually committed. But in another very interesting part of the book, Mary Lincoln was unstable, as you said. She was in and out. Abraham Lincoln loved her, but she gave Abraham Lincoln a very hard time. However, U.S. Grant was supposed to be at that play the night that Lincoln was assassinated, and Booth knew that. And Booth was going to kill both Grant and Lincoln. But Grant didn't show up because his wife, Julia, didn't like Mary Lincoln and refused to go and said to U.S., hey, I'm not going anywhere with this loon. You're going to go back to New Jersey with me. And that's exactly what happened, sparing Grant's life.
So the lesson to be learned, gentlemen, is if your wife doesn't want to go to a play,
don't
you,
go.
You have no, that's right, don't go. That, one of the many
lessons. This is what made me want to write this book. There's so much of this stuff.
What about
people just don't know?
Was he sufficiently guarded?
No, and that would be the question I would ask Abraham Lincoln if I ever get to heaven. I'm assuming he's there. That he knew, Lincoln knew he was going to be killed. He had a premonition, a very scary premonition, which I think is the strongest part of my book, that we outline a premonition that Lincoln had, a historical fact, and it's so close to what really happened. It's amazing. So Lincoln knew he was going to be killed. But he didn't up his security. In fact, he had terrible security. And his main security guard went drinking. Well, he should have been outside guarding Lincoln. He was in a bar next door to the Ford Theater, which allowed Booth to come right on up with the Derringer.
Well, did Booth know that the defenses?
No, he didn't know. That was just a break for Booth.
So, right, I'm saying then he had no certitude that his plan would work?
No. He showed up at Ford's Theater that night. He had a plan. He had drilled a hole in the box where Lincoln was watching the play so he could see inside. But he didn't know what he was going to find in there. But he was willing to, you know, take the shot.
And how quickly did he die?
Oh, it took Lincoln 16, 18 hours. And then we go through almost minute by minute, what happened to him and how the doctors tried to save him. It's almost like a CSI thing.
Was he conscious at all at the time?
Well, he responded to voices, like Mary Lincoln's, his wife. He responded to that, but he couldn't speak.
Was the nation's reaction to the assassination was massive grief or divided?
Well, it was the first reaction was brutal. People were going around hunting Confederate sympathizers, beating them up in the streets. There was all kinds of things like that. And then there was a prolonged period of mourning.
Yeah, as one would imagine. Who were the heroes, if any, in this story?
Well, the detective who caught Booth, that's why I originally decided to write this, because I had never heard of this guy, Lafayette Baker, New York City detective, shadowy guy. And he was called in because they couldn't find Booth after he got away. They didn't know where he was. So they call this guy down. He was a former spy for the Union, and Stanton, the Secretary of War, who's another shadowy guy, calls him in to try to find Booth. And Lafayette Baker does find him. So I guess you could say that Baker is a hero in the sense that he got Booth. You know, the main hero in the book is the president. And, you know, we show what he did and how he suffered. When he took office, Dennis, he was a strapping six-footer with a bill like Arnold Schwarzenegger. 3 years later, he's hunched over and had aged 30 years. We show you the pictures.
Yeah, you do.
I mean, he suffered an unbelievable amount yeah. for his country.
Well, his greatness comes through. Listen, yes. Bill, you did a great job. I'm serious.
And I appreciate it very much, and thank you for reading it.
Absolutely. All right, take care, my friend.
All right,
all right. Bye. And welcome back. The O'Reilly book, Killing Lincoln, is up at DennisPrager.com. And I admire him for taking on the subject. Could have written another, easy potboiler, so to speak. You know, why I don't like liberals. Would have been number one also. All right, welcome back. By the way, laundry, if he did write a book on laundry in early Massachusetts, I think I would have picked it up. That's true. You don't know much about the subject either? Wow. I was looking to you, actually. The reason that I would read it is I learned over time the best way to learn history is through a specific moment, a specific person, a specific event. A broad history is usually too difficult to remember. You just in 1856 the following happened, then this happened in Congress, and then this happened in foreign affairs, and then you just move on. But if you really did read a book on how they did laundry in early Massachusetts, you'd learn an immense amount. What is life like? And all of the surrounding issues. You'd probably learn, for example, that you couldn't do the laundry on Sunday. Wow, religion played such an important role in early Massachusetts. No, I'm serious. Just that. Or, they had to fetch their water from so far away. Who knows? Anyway, welcome back to the program. Count me as one who is on the suspicious side with regard to Amanda Knox's innocence. The American media went overboard to paint her as a victim. This is the liberal media, interestingly enough, and in Italy, it did not earn the American media a great deal of respect. If you read Ann Coulter on the issue, just let me give you an example. She wrote this in September. That's last month. Knox's first of several alibis for the night of the murder was that she was at her boyfriend and co-defendant Salicito's house all night, sound asleep until 10 a.m. the next morning. A few days later, when that was proved false by telephone records, eyewitnesses, and Salicito's admission that it was a lie, Knox claimed she was in the house during Meredith's murder, and she knew who the murderer was. She said it was her boss, Patrick Lumumba, the owner of a popular bar in town. He wanted her. Raffaele and I went into another room, that's Salicito, and then I heard screams. Patrick and Meredith were in Meredith's bedroom while I think I stayed in the kitchen. I can't remember how long they were together in the bedroom, but the only thing I can say is that at a certain point I remember hearing Meredith's screams and I covered my ears. I can't remember if Meredith was screaming and if I heard thuds, but I could imagine what was going on. Solely because of Knox's claim that Lumumba murdered Meredith, he was arrested and sat in jail for 2 weeks before being released when the police discovered about 100 eyewitnesses who could place him at his bar all night, the night of the murder. Knox's effort to frame an innocent man was nothing but a desperate attempt to throw suspicion off herself. In the process, she inadvertently revealed that she knew something only the police knew about the murder, that Meredith had also been sexually assaulted. And the article goes on and on. By the way, isn't that a bit bizarre? Your roommate is screaming, and what you do is hold your ears? You don't knock on the door and say, are you okay? Even the lie isn't very persuasive, let alone reflecting awfully on her. I don't know. Maybe it's the pretty young woman defense. Recall that perhaps as a possibility in another case in the United States with the death of a baby. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe not. But the fact that they didn't have the DNA, that's it? We now only convict with DNA? All I know is there a woman horrifically assaulted and murdered, and no justice for that poor family, except, well, that drifter that they know did kill her. He's in prison there in Italy. Well, what is our favorite liberal's favorite comment? Better that 100 guilty go free than at one guilty be sentenced. I never found that all that persuasive, to be honest. Do they really mean that? Let 100 murderers go free? Won't 100 murderers, at least a few of them, murder again? I mean, I understand the sentiment behind it because of the horror of sentencing an innocent person. But the cavalier way with which it's said that 100 murderers can go free and we don't pay a price in innocent lives. I'm not saying I don't believe Knox is going to kill anybody. It's not my point. It was just reflection on that point. Yeah. Well, be very interesting to see what happens to her name. I guess most Americans, what do most Americans believe, that she is innocent? Yeah, I guess so. Well, the media have really gone, I don't know why. What, because it's an American? Because it's a pretty young girl? Because she's sweet looking? I don't know. What is the reason? Wonder if it were an ugly male, if they would have gone as full board, full steam ahead in the American media. 1-8-PRAGER-776. Is the number. I want to read to you when we come back. I want to read to you the proposed list of demands for the Occupy Wall Street movement. Occupy Wall Street. The resistance continues at Liberty Square and nationwide. The resistance. What are they resisting? We resist freedom. We resist a free society. Wow. You got to be quite a character to believe that in the United States of America there is even such a thing as the resistance. The resistance was the name given to those who fought the Nazis in World War II. You're listening to the Dennis Prager Show. Hi, everybody. Dennis Prager here. Mountain View, California. Michael, thank you for calling. Michael, Dennis Prager.
Hi, Dennis. Hey, I love your show. I think you're off base, though, with the Amanda Knox case. Well, I mean, there are all kinds of problems, basically, with the case against her. But to me, the one argument that not only, you know, raises reasonable doubt about her guilt, but really proves her innocence, is that if you look at this crime scene, this is a messy, messy, messy crime scene, and Rudy Guede, the drifter that you mentioned, evidence of him is all over that room. He left handprints, he left footprints, he left his DNA. There's absolutely nothing of Amanda or Solicito in that room. And that's just not possible. It's not possible if they participated in the murder for them to have selectively cleaned all evidence of them from that room and left evidence of the real murderer. I think it's very clear that...
How do you deal... That's a very good challenge. I said I was skeptical. I didn't pronounce. I don't have the right to make a pronouncement. I said I was skeptical. I read why. So deal, I'll find out. I'll get an answer to your question. It seems to me to be a fair question. How do you answer the lying... if you were accused of murder, would you point to someone who you knew to be completely innocent?
Well, her story, which I find believable, of course,
that the police coerced the name out of her.
That's correct.
Okay, I find that bizarre.
A 20 or 21-year-old kid. She, everybody describes her as gullible and naive. The police told her that they had rock solid evidence that she was in the house at the time of the murder. That wasn't true, but they told her that, and she believed it. And they were the ones, according to her, they were the ones who suggested her boss as the murderer, not her. She didn't just...
Yeah, I know she made that up. But she made up so many things that I don't think she has credibility.
She made up this story after an all-night interrogation. They kept her up all night.
Well, she said that she was at her boyfriend and sleeping till 10 a.m.
Right.
Do you believe that?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. All the evidence is consistent with that. That's what she said.
Well, according to Ann Coulter's column, a few days later when that was proved false by telephone records, eyewitnesses, and Solachito's admission that it was a lie, Knox claimed she was in the house during Meredith's murder. So she changed from, I was sleeping with my boyfriend at his place, to, yeah, you're right, I was in my place.
That's right. Well, that's right. Look, I wish if I had been in that position, I would have the strength not to implicate somebody else falsely.
No, forgetting the implication. Just you would... One presumes that if you were accused of murder in anywhere but Iran... where they would start plucking out your fingernails, you would just say, well, I couldn't have done it because I was in X. You wouldn't make up a lie.
Well, that's right. But like I said, I mean, they kept her up all night. They badgered her all night that night. And at the end of this all-night interrogation, and it was an all-week interrogation, actually. She had been interrogated by the police for over 40 hours that week. She, and again, the police telling her this guy, I can't pronounce his name, Lumumba or something like that.
Yeah, Lumumba.
About Lumumba. And eventually, yes, she said, I have a vague memory of being in the house. I have a vague memory of hearing screams. And shortly after that,
Do you believe she did hear screams or didn't?
No, I believe she was sleeping all night in her house. Her mind made up this crazy story.
Okay, all right, look, we have to buy a lot more with your defense than we than with the guilt presumption. But I appreciate, look, you may be right. Look, I hope you're right. I hope she's innocent. I do. I don't want a murderer free, and my heart breaks for the victim, who is a non-issue in all of this, and her parents and her friends and relatives. Maybe you're right. I hope you're right. You're listening to The Dennis Prager Show. Hi, everybody. Dennis Prager here. Don't forget to visit Prager University and to send the courses to as many people as possible. It's free, though we live by... It's a 501c3, in case you're looking for a worthy place to contribute to. Prager University would be a very worthy one. It is tax deductible. We are trying to have the greatest thinkers living present the greatest ideas possible in 5-minute segments to undo the damage of the universities in the other direction. PragerU.com. Very simple. P-R-A-G-E-R-U. Prageru. Prageru. Doesn't that sound like an animal? Jesus, there was a beautiful Prageru at the zoo the other day. Listen to the proposed list of demands for Occupy Wall Street, which is getting sympathetic attention from the mainstream liberal commentators like the Los Angeles Times and Nicholas Kristof at the New York Times, they're saying this is the left-wing response equivalent to the Tea Party. Okay, here we go. Ready? Demand one. Restoration of the living wage. So the government should adjudicate and legislate what wages are. This demand can only be met by ending quote-unquote free trade by reimposing trade tariffs on all imported goods entering the American market. We know, by the way, from history, how good that has been for the average American to put tariffs. Among other things, they should know, but they're ignoramuses. This is all emotion. Leftism is all emotion. I make the point in my forthcoming book on which is one-third is about the left. And it's always emotion-based. Just hating the rich is an emotion. It's not a plan that works. It's not working in Europe. I don't know what will happen in Europe, by the way. There is very real reason to fear for Europe. The welfare state doesn't work. It can work in Germany for a longer period than it can work in Greece because Germany produces so many exportable goods so that foreign countries can finance the large government. But over time, it won't work in Germany either. Germany has another problem induced by secular leftism, and that is people don't want to reproduce. Life is how much vacation time can I get? Not how can I take care of children and self-sacrifice. There is no self-sacrifice demanded by the left. The whole sacrifice is of those who are the most productive. Otherwise, the only question is, what can you do for me? So, by the way, the more demands they make, the better it is. People should know who these people are, these generally bored, confused narcissists who are in this Occupy Wall Street movement. And I have no love for Wall Street, but I'm not emotion-driven in making policy. Demand number two, institute a universal single-payer healthcare system. To do this, all private insurers must be banned from the healthcare market. There you go. Okay, so we should outlaw private insurance in this country. Demand number three, guaranteed living wage income regardless of employment. Whether you work or not, you should be paid as if you were employed. That'll really induce people to work hard. I know. I hope it doesn't happen because Alan will retire. Demand number four, free college education. I am sure they mean through graduate school. I can't believe they only mean college as opposed to free university education. Demand number five, begin a fast-track process to bring the fossil fuel economy to an end while at the same time bringing the alternative energy economy up to energy demand. Isn't that what they tried with, what was the name of that again? Solidano, what was the name of that company? Solyndro, yeah. That was exactly what they tried. Half a billion dollars. Demand six, $1 trillion in infrastructure. Water, sewer, rail, roads and bridges, and electric grid. Demand number seven, $1 trillion in ecological restoration, planting forests, reestablishing wetlands and the natural flow of river systems, and decommissioning of all of America's nuclear power plants. Demand number eight, racial and gender equal rights amendment. Racial? Now, the gender, the equal rights amendment on gender was that you get equal pay for equal work. So will that would apply, I guess, to races too, because it doesn't matter. Demand number nine, open borders migration. Anyone can travel anywhere to work and live. So that means that anyone from anywhere can come into the United States. What we would have is a flood, needless to say. I don't blame anybody for doing so. Hundreds of millions of people, perhaps, or 100 million people, would come into the United States. And these people, and now, once you're in the U.S., you would get these other demands fulfilled, so we would pay you even if you didn't get work. Once you were in the U.S., and citizenship would no longer matter. I have to believe that the L.A. Times and Nicholas Kristof, a sweet and spectacularly naive human being, spectacularly naive. He has a childlike view of the world that is just possible in Midtown Manhattan. The man number 10, bring American elections up to international standards of a paper ballot precinct counted and recounted. Okay. Number 11. Now I'll give you 11, 12, and 13 when we come back. Okay, I hope that this becomes well known. You're listening to the Dennis Prager Show. Hello, my friends, and welcome back to the Dennis Prager Show, or welcome to it. I'm up to demand number 11 on the Occupy Wall Street website, the proposed list of demands. It's so interesting. I remember this so well, this reprise here of the 1960s, 70s. The left of my generation would have a list, except that they called it non-negotiable demands. And even as a kid, I just realized how totalitarian that is. Non-negotiable demands. And I thought at the time, it's so childish. That's what babies do. That's what two-year-olds have, non-negotiable demands. The adult has negotiable demands, unless we're talking about evil, you know, like free me from this prison camp where I've been falsely put and arrested. Number 11, immediate across-the-board debt forgiveness for all. Debt forgiveness of sovereign debt, commercial loans, home mortgages, home equity loans, credit card debt, student loans, and personal loans now! Exclamation point. All debt must be stricken from the books. You know, I'm starting to like these guys. Really? No mortgage? Who does the idiot think will pay for that bill? That business has the money to cover it. I see. Wow. All $65 trillion must be stricken from the books. I mean, all debt on the entire planet, period. Demand 12, outlaw all credit reporting agencies. Okay, I'm glad that this is where they're at. I accept that the LA Times and New York Times had positive things to say about them. See, this is what has happened, my friends, and that this is the biggest change in American life, politically speaking. There used to be a huge difference between liberal and left. There is no longer. You're listening to the Dennis Prager Show.